everybody, and welcome to another version of Magical Musings. I'm your host, Joy, and on the other end of the line is Brian, as always.
Howdy, folks.
And today we're going to be
talking... It's been a while. It's good to see you again.
to talk to everybody again or something, yeah. Today we're going to be doing something a little bit different. We are going to be doing a normal show, but it's going to be a lot more scattered than it normally is. And I know that that's really hard to do, tonight's show is episode 18, I think, and it's going to be a catch-all. And so come on in, grab some tea, grab some cookies, sit down, and we'll talk for the next 2 hours about everything that the 101 books don't. All right, so like I said, essentially what we're going to do is tonight's show we were going to do on spirits and working with spirits and familiars and... disembodied people and things like that. But it's also topics that we've touched on in about three other shows. So I don't know if we've got enough information to fill out an entire two-hour block. So essentially what we're going to do is we're not going to have any governors on the discussion tonight. Brian and I are going to start talking. If it gets back to spirits, then that's great. If not, then we're just going to wander everywhere. So... we're going to call this the catch-all show and just see how it goes, okay?
Fair enough. So, yeah, I mean, we've just finished celebrating Samhain. At least I'm pretty sure that you and I both did.
Yeah. It was here.
And I've
we
had
still
a
got
few...
candy left over. Southern Hemisphere people, not so much. They just did Beltanya. So.
It's true. Yeah, and I mean, I didn't do a whole lot this year. Mid-October, my sister came into town, and we basically went on a several-hour ghost bus tour thing, touring local cemeteries and whatnot.
Okay.
And
that's
yeah,
always fun.
And I was. Well, I had to work that night, so I was expecting to either miss out because some problems arose that made me kind of have to stay late, and I basically sent my sister on with her friend, and she kind of was like, well, why? And I said, well, because I won't be able to fix this before the thing is over, so or before the thing starts, because it was a we meet at 7:30 and we leave right away. So I was like, okay. And then I managed to fix it about 15 minutes after I sent them away, and then I was kind of pissed off because of it. And then my boss was like, well, what time does it start? And I said, 7:30. Why? Because I'll probably be able to drive you out there. And I was like, okay, fair enough.
Cool.
Let's do what we can do.
Hey.
Yeah, so we managed it with about 10 minutes to spare. And then I got on the bus, and we were having technical issues with the audio system. So they weren't able to, like, do the speaking part of the tour while we were driving because of the staticky, awful audio.
My goodness.
And
imagine.
We ended up, like,
technical difficulties
I know,
over audio.
And we ended up... well, it was so stupid because we ended up delayed for like a half hour because we were just sitting there waiting for the other bus to come along. And I was like, oh, really? We went through all of that and I was panicking over it because I'd spent like $35 on a ticket the month before making reservations. And yeah. Apparently, there was just technical problems all over the place. So,
well, I mean,
it was interesting, but not $35 interesting.
Yeah, I'm sorry. A tour of graveyards, while certainly spooky and Halloween-y and everything like that, it just that doesn't appeal to me at all. It's like, okay, we're seeing a lot of gravestones. Yay!
Well, that was it, right? It was. The whole idea was that it was going to be a ghost tour of the city, and basically that meant we were touring a few graveyards, talking about some ghost sightings around town, and there's actually an alley in the city called Fantan Alley, which is right in Chinatown, which, you know, consists of one square block, like one block of one street, and then this alley that cuts through. And basically, it's actually been on TV, so it's like known across the country, if not farther than that. And we heard the story of that, and I don't know, it wasn't my thing. It was more for my sister's sake, because she's into that, and, you know, I was into it, you know, in my teens. But I figured this was a good way to get, you know. But yeah, basically we were discussing, we're just doing this ghost thing for my sister's sake, and then we did it.
I'm going to be receiving them in about 2 days. Okay, bye-bye. Sorry about that. We're going to have to start cutting that out.
Fair enough.
No.
But yeah.
I get a call that is about diabetic supplies for my wife, and it's like, what? Never mind. Anyhow. Okay.
to make it a long story short, basically, it's not really my thing. And I did it for my sister's sake, because it gives us a chance to hang out for Halloween, because... Yeah, I mean, she doesn't really do much otherwise.
Well, I mean, so, family is the central focus of Halloween. It's just your dead family instead of your live ones. So it kind of works out. You know, my Halloween was spent with a big haunted house on the Astral for a bunch of dead people and facilitating them talking to their live ancestors. It's kind of interesting looking at it from the other side. I mean, you always have the dumb supper where you lay the places for your ancestors and, you know, you serve them food and you talk and everything. But I don't think anybody's ever really looked at it from the opposite side of the dead person coming back to sit down at the table and be with you. It was kind of weird. It's like booths with a window that you can look through and that you can hear and you can see. It was kind of cool, actually. That was fun.
Interesting.
Yeah. It was kind of cool.
That probably would have been more
interesting and fun.
That would
know.
Have been more interesting than, yeah. standing on a windy beach talking about some supposed ghost that has, like, the capacity to basically fly around up and down, like, you know, the witch in The Wizard of Oz. You know, it was like, oh, great. That's so interesting.
Yay. All right, flying.
But actually, it was interesting, though, because they did mention the rather well-known Wiccan author in our city, who actually wrote a book that I read as a kid that talked about ghosts and, you know, spirit exorcisms and that sort of thing. So that was interesting to hear.
Nice segue into tonight's topic, so that's always good. First off, while we're thinking about it, I want to just acknowledge that one of the Car Talk brothers that we've kind of modeled the show after passed away here recently. He was something like 89 years old. I mean, he was really up there, and he's a really funny guy, so I just want to say, you know, hi. Sorry you're dead. We loved you. I don't know how to put this. It's, you know, acknowledging that he died. And that's what, you know, Samhain is about. We've talked about this aspect of it in our Samhain show that we did about a year and a half ago, I think. It was a while ago.
Probably somewhere thereabouts. Yeah.
Like. It's up on the website, magicalmusings.net. So if you want to listen to it, come, you know, it's another two-hour show. It's us trying to be intelligent, but failing miserably, I think. Anyway,
we must never admit that.
Look, you want to know one of the great secrets of the elders? They know just as little as you do, They just bullshit more effectively.
That is true, actually. It really is. Like, and you find that... Sorry, yeah, go ahead.
No, you find that out as you go on, and you don't really, it doesn't really smack you in the face until somebody starts coming to you with questions about stuff that you asked about when you were a new pagan. And then you go, I still don't know shit about this topic, and I'm answering questions for it. I'm just a really good bullshitter.
See, that's the funny thing. I remember that exact scenario when I was hanging out on Second Life during the pagan discussion groups that we'd have every month or every week or whatever. And, I mean, there was always the loudmouth new pagans who knew it all. And, you know, they were always like, oh, there's nothing so terrible in the world as a Christian because of all the... you know, nonsense of the past and so on. It was like, okay, well, that's wonderful, but what else is there to your path than hating on Christians?
Yeah, and that's the big thing.
So,
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, no, that's the big thing.
I mean, it was just...
I mean, it's... When you first start out, you do have to get radical and very anti-Christian for a little while. And... To you know, acknowledge this, there is a lot of stuff about Christianity that does not sit right with people who actually think about their faith path, okay? However, that being said, problems of history can't be carried over into present day. Okay, yes, they had the Inquisition, burning the heretics and the Jews and the people that didn't believe straight mainline stuff out of the Catholic Church in Spain. There was the witch scares in Salem and across Europe. There were, you know, the Black Death and the plague and everything like that. And then the 91 Theses that Martin Luther stapled to the church door. I mean, all of that, you've got to acknowledge it and go, okay, that helped shape the church as it currently is. Let's not hate every Christian because of what happened in the past, but let's look at how they're doing now. I mean, if we're going to hate them for things that happened centuries ago, then they have every right to hate us because we went around and slaughtered Christians prior to Christianity becoming the dominant faith. We enslaved them and butchered them and used them as sacrifices. They were, you know, outcasts, and Christianity was seen as a cult. So they have to blame us for that, and we have to accept it if we're going to be blaming them for the Inquisition and everything. So you can't really do that. Go ahead.
Because you can't really hold on to the past and then blame people for the past and then say... the past, and then say, we're going to carry that shit into the future. Because, I mean, at what point do you let go of that problematic stuff and then grow beyond it, you know?
I mean, you have to acknowledge that it happened.
It's a question you have to ask.
Yeah, you have to acknowledge that it happened and that those events were part of shaping how it is now. But either you're going to blame them for the past and accept all the blame they heap on you for the past, or you both can go, okay, that's the past. Let's not repeat those mistakes. Let's move on from there and do something good now.
Well, exactly. And honestly, I mean, one of the things that I've found over the years is that the more you look into the so-called Christian holidays, the more you recognize how completely influenced or completely pagan they are, and how completely oblivious Christians are to that, and how resistant they are to learning anything about those things. Mm-hmm. You get the like hardcore ones who are like, no, Leviticus 23 says these are biblical holidays and you can't celebrate Christmas or Easter or, you know, whatever. And then it's like, does any of that really matter? I mean, in the course of a spiritual path, you're supposed to live in the present and, you know, have it change you. So where holidays are coming from doesn't really define the way you particularly practice it.
And it shouldn't, like, really. I mean, every religion rips off aspects of the previous religions. Okay, I mean, you want an example of paganism ripping off the previous religion? The Yule log is a primary example, okay? Now, there's going to be a lot of people that are listening to this that are going, but the Yule log was pagan itself. Yeah, the Yule log was around in the northern tradition, in the Vanic traditions, prior to paganism or the druidic traditions that we know now existed. As far as I can tell, there is no Gaelic, Celtic path that has a log as a sacrifice that you decorate up and burn it to the gods to bring the light back. But that's exactly what Yule logs are and what they do. We took it from them. Christianity took it from us, you know, and so you're constantly pulling elements from other places. You know, a good example of Christianity pulling from paganism is Beltane. What the hell does Easter and the birth of Christ have to do with eggs, chickens, and rabbits? You know, nothing. It's a fertility holiday, as we've stated before. So, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, and the gods of the old become the demons of the new. You know, the horned deity became Satan somehow. And it's part of it, I think, is a real.
Well, and it's.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I was just thinking about this documentary that was on, I want to say Biography at some point, that was called something or other, but it was basically a biography of Satan and how they drew from pagan gods. And, you know, like, you've got Pan's influence with the horns and the hooves, and you've got, like, the trident of Poseidon, and you've got, like, all these other little influences that are basically pulled at random from, like, pre-existent mythologies and then tacked on to the, you know, the devil. Like, you know, pinning a tail on a donkey. it's the best way I can think of comparing
it.
I mean, it's basically like...
It's wonderful.
There's no... I mean, the devil is just an amorphous concept that, you know, they've come up with as the enemy. And, I mean, if you compare that to previous scriptural descriptions, I mean, you've got the Dead Sea Scrolls that talk about an enemy, an adversary, whatever. But it's not like he's basically a person, you know. And then you get the Christians who go, well, no, I mean, it can't possibly be right, because if we tack on the horns and the tail and give him a pagan god's fork, then he's, you know, that much more scary and, you know, so on. But I think ultimately that he's only sort of been cobbled together within the past few centuries.
Yeah, I think so. I do know that some of the associations made were done when other religions moved into the area. Like, let's take the British Isles. The Romans are moving into the area. It's post-Jesus. And the cult of Mithras has mostly been pushed underground and taken over by the Jesus mythos in Rome, and it's become the state religion now. Okay, so now we're in Gaul, and we're in Britain, and we're where the Celts are, and they see this deity that is a lightning god. And he controls the thunder and the rain, and he brings it, and it nourishes the crops. And, you know, that's really similar to the big god up here, you know, and that we worship, you know. So we've got the same gods, you know, so instead of going to your temple, why don't you come to my temple and we can, you know, worship together the same deity. And then, you know, you can get baptized and you can, you know, you can learn the teachings of our deity, you know, which are the same as yours. And you're already, you know, mostly worshiping that god. So, you know, let's just sit down and, you know, worship the same god together just in a different temple. And then I can say you've been converted. You know, and that's pretty much what I expect
happened.
Well,
and that's the funny thing. Yeah, that's pretty much how it's described in a lot of historical records, basically, is the idea that basically the Romans were like, well, we've been adopting everyone else's gods and, you know, the mythologies are all comparable. So essentially you get pre-Christian mystery cults that are, you know, spanning the globe. I mean, basically there's every culture around the Middle East and the Mediterranean that has its own mystery cults. Basically it's like sun gods who, you know, die and rise again at, you know, similar points in the year to what we now see in the Christian calendar. And ultimately, I mean, you look at, Constantine, who was the founder of what became the Christian religion, and he never actually converted until, like, he was on his deathbed, basically, because what he'd done was to cobble aspects of Apollonian worship and Mithraic worship and Christian worship and so on and so forth into a cult of himself, basically. I mean, there's a statue that, I mean, it's parts of a statue anyway. It's like his head and hands and stuff, that he built where he's basically depicted as the sun god. He has a crown, like a rayed crown, and, you know, he's like gigantic and so on. So, I mean, he basically saw himself as a manifestation of the sun god who was also Christ and Mithras and so on.
And it's not the first time that that's happened. I mean, it's been theorized for a long, long time that Tutankhamun's father, who demanded, was the same pharaoh that demanded that all of Egypt worship one deity, a sun god, and that's why Tutankhamun was thrown down from his throne so quickly, because they didn't think that he could, you know, his father was abandoning Ra and Isis and Bast and everybody else, you know, to go to this one deity, solar deity type thing, and setting, you know, the pharaoh set himself up as the head of that church and demanded everybody worship him, and somehow he died. And then his son got the throne, and he died too. Huh. And then suddenly we go back to all the old gods again. Interesting.
Well, I think Egyptian history is fascinating. I mean, the whole idea of the religious history of Egypt is that it went through a period, like, dating back thousands of years, where it was basically an animistic sort of spirituality. Mm-hmm. Then it becomes this polytheistic religion that's very structured and so on. But I think what happened was that ultimately it was a series of mystery cults, and, you know, there was obviously the Osiris focus, where it was like the dying and resurrecting god. And I think Akhenaten, Tutankhamun's father, basically was an advanced mystic in like a mystery cult, and drew from his own experience the name that he was going to have as the main name of the deity, which was not like
Amun-Ra,
a persona. It was like light. It was light itself, mm-hmm. Manifested as the sun disk. And so the whole idea of religion was changed to what sort of later influenced Gnosticism. Mm-hmm. So you've got like the mystery cults that all have the same experience in Greece and so on. And then it carries through, and it's almost like Egypt kind of dug in its heels and said, no, 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 that's weird and different. And, you know, they basically went back to a fundamentalist polytheism.
Gee,
where
imagine.
It's like, no, no, no.
People not wanting
so
to change.
That's, well, exactly. I mean, because people were comfortable with their house deities and, you know, with the, oh, that little dude is like a little fat, ugly god thing. I think his name is Bess. He's basically like a little house god, and he's kind of depicted as an ugly, squat goblin kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And people were very comfortable with him, so they were like, well, why would we get rid of him, who we can see or at least depict, for an, you know,
for a
big light.
Burning disc of light, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's fascinating when you look at the history of religions over, you know, the course of the past several thousand years, because I think it carries forward into modern paganism as well. Sorry, speaking of more of the borrowing from the past, I mean, you've got like the influence of ceremonial magic in modern Wicca, which is a medieval Judeo-Christian experiment, I guess, in Gnostic and Hermetic thought.
Yeah, and like, you know, like we've said before and like we said earlier in this program, you know, you borrow from the past because it really sucks to have to relearn everything again. I mean, if you're going to sit down and develop a faith path, that's great, but why do you have to start with the animism of this rock has a soul and then develop into a rain god and then develop into a god of morals? And, you know, all over again. So you're going to start with a basic structure of you have personified people who are doing different jobs and represent different things, which is a pretty advanced thought when you stop and think about it. Because, you know, cavemen, I don't think would be, they might be capable of understanding that the rain is different from the sunshine. I don't think that they would associate a person with causing the rain, however, until you get several generations down the line. You know, call me
well,
strange.
I imagine that originally, well, I think that originally it would have been just the idea that rain happened and therefore it must have had a cause. And, you know, obviously they didn't have meteorology and climatology and so on, so they didn't really understand what was going on with the whole water cycle and so on and so forth. And so they ascribed the notion that the rain must be caused by a spirit. And if it doesn't rain for a long time and we start dying because we're, you know, thirsty, then it must be because we pissed off this rain spirit. So naturally, if you find ways to appease the rain spirit, so that you can bring the rain that you need, suddenly life makes a little more sense because you have some way of controlling the situation instead of being at the mercy of this miserable rain spirit who just stops rain whenever it feels like it.
And this, ladies and gentlemen, is how you develop deities, because you start with somebody that, you start with the spirit of a food store of a crop or something, and it develops into a person over time. Now, the theory is that it's kind of a chicken and egg thing with the gods. Did we develop the gods, or did the gods develop us? And I kind of think that the answer is yes, which made a lot of people go, what? But when you have a cycle, you don't have a beginning or an end. What you have is you have people interacting at different points. And so, yes, the gods created us, but then we created the gods as well. And it changes depending upon where you're looking at the cycle.
Well, and I think, too, that people would have had to give the gods their faces. Each person is going to see a deity in a different way. I mean, mm-hmm. like, take Bast, for instance. You're never going to get two people to agree to the specific details of what Bast looks like, you know, because some experience her as a, you know, black cat or whatever, and some would experience her as a calico or, you know, whatever. So there's going to be particulars that vary according to individuals, whereas we can all agree that Bast, according to the mythology, is depicted with a cat's head. Mm-hmm. She also takes the form of a cat or whatever. So you can do that with almost any god. There's not going to be one god that two people see identically. It's going to be a matter of, well, you know, and churches are founded on the idea, or temples, you know, et cetera, are founded on the idea that these people sort of have a general concept of a similar looking deity. Mm-hmm. So they can agree not to kill each other over the particulars. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's where you get like the Northern European version of Jesus, who is the blonde, blue eyed, you know, white dude pinned to a cross. And, you know, the Eastern Orthodox, who's got like the brunette dude with brown eyes, you know, pinned to a cross. And basically, I mean, you get variety across the spectrum, mm-hmm. but there are characteristics that everyone sort of understands to be the mark that says that is Jesus, or that is Bast, or that is Odin.
Mm-hmm. And I find it, you know, really interesting that in cultural shifts, when let's take one of the best known Celtic versions of Lu. Okay, you have Lu Samaldonich in Ireland, who is Lu the Many-Skilled, who comes into Terra and essentially takes over. He is skilled in everything. He's the son of a Fomorian raised by a Ferbalag, and he is like the culmination of everybody. And then you move over to Wales, and then you have Lu La Giffey's, and I keep trying to pronounce it as the Welshwood, which I can't do for some reason, but he's Lu the Long-Handed. Uses a spear, kills a sparrow at one point, king of the upper world and the summer and the light, and gets killed by a king of the dark world, and goes to the underworld during the winter. And then you move over into Gaul, France and Spain and Greece and everywhere in there, over on the continent, and you've got Lug, L-U-G, who is also a solar deity, god of light, and it's essentially the same deity, just, you know, slightly changed for their particular cultural identity. And, you know, it can be, even be argued that Loki of the Norse is the same deity. And I've seen evidences and written a couple articles on it, too, where Lu Samaldonich and Loki are the same god. So you've got that one
as well. That actually would make sense, because you've got a lot of people who worship Loki as a fire deity. Mm-hmm. So it does make sense, because, I mean...
And if he's a frost giant,
fire is
how can
both
he be...
wild and destructive, so... Mm-hmm.
Well, the
well,
argument
exactly.
is...
It's...
The argument is that Lu Samaldonich is not a deity of the sun. He's a deity of the lightning, which is very, very different, because the lightning presages the rain, and the rain is a blessed release from the burning of the sun. And it's argued that in the myth of the Second Battle of Moytura, that Balor, One-Eye, whose baleful stare can destroy people, is actually the sun just shining down and shining down and shining down and withering crops and making people burned and everything like that, and that it is actually Lu Samaldonich throwing the spear so that the eye comes out the back of the head and looks at the armies behind him, which is the lightning flash, which is bringing the relief of the rain.
Well, that's interesting now that you say that, because now I'm thinking in terms of Balor being Bell, who's the one named, or for whom Beltane is named.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, that does make a lot of sense. And I just wanted to add as a side note that's totally unrelated to paganism. Lug is also the dude that's trying to make a pass at Mad Mardigan in the movie Willow. That's
okay.
Right.
I don't remember that. I have to go back and re-see that movie.
Oh, wait. Lug is the one where in the bar, Willow's trying to feed the baby and trying to ask around the bar if they have milk to feed her. And then Mad Mardigan, who hasn't seen Willow in a while, is dressed as a woman, and he's been having this affair with Lug's wife. And what happens is the soldiers come in looking for Willow and the baby, and Mad Mardigan's facing down the soldier, the head soldier, the evil queen's wife or daughter, and the soldier chick challenges him and says, you're rather strong for a woman. And then she like grabs his clothes and rips them off him and goes, you're not a woman. And then Lug comes in behind and says, not a woman, not a woman. And then like slugs the soldiers. So yeah, Lug is the bully guy. I just thought I'd mention that because it's an amusing scene in that movie.
I'll have to go back and see that again. I don't remember that. Anyway, so relating back to spirits, because everything relates to back to tarot.
It does, somehow. Yeah. This one's a little looser, but
yeah,
we'll figure it out.
Somehow. One of the things that I wanted to talk about is the fact that on the astral, your perception defines what you perceive. If you want to see it in 20th century England, you will. If you want to see it in 10th century Native American tribal life, you will. But you really have to believe it, and you have to know you're seeing it. And the person with the most belief in it wins. And I mean, you've got all these spirits and souls running around. Understand something, that even if they don't look anything like you think that they should look like, or you're not experiencing them in a way that you think you should, they're still people. They just want to appear that way for some reason, and so they deserve your respect as a person. Okay, if you would not poke around in somebody else's wallet or purse because that's rude, then, you know, don't poke around in somebody else's past or their brain without their permission, because it's basically the same thing. Okay, there's like I said, a lot of this we've covered in other shows. Just some specific things that we didn't cover. Another one that I know we didn't cover is familiars. Okay, and any study of familiars themselves is really, really fascinating, simply due to the fact that it's not something that a lot of people look into, and there's so much scope for discovery. Okay, a lot of people seem to think that familiars take the shape of animals, and those animals are born animals, and that they become magical helpers. And I'm here to tell you that that's not true. Okay, familiars, as defined by the Bible, with King Solomon going to visit the Witch of Endor and looking for somebody with a familiar spirit, is a spirit. It is a soul or a person or a creature that exists only in the spirit plane that helps the person that they are tied to. Okay, so in this case, the Witch of Endor with her familiar spirit could just be a psychic medium, and that's all she is. She's somebody that channels dead spirits They give information to King Solomon. He goes out, slaughters people, and then comes back and kills her. And that's,
of course,
that's essentially what a familiar is. Now, when we started getting into the Dark Ages and the Malleus Maleficarum, that's when it started becoming a familiar is an animal. Okay, and that's because it was believed that the demons of hell could become, could become animals that could be interacted with. Okay.
And it was that, so that they could disguise themselves in human company.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, obviously they had a hate on for cats because cats are nocturnal and, you know, bats are the birds of the devil and all this kind of weird nonsense.
Well, I find it interesting that the pogrom that they had against cats and getting rid of the cats and going out and finding all the cats because cats are evil led directly to the Black Plague because they got rid of all the mousers who would kill the mice that were carrying the fleas that caused bubonic plague. Kind of stupid, but
that's
it's
precisely
what
it.
Happened.
It's very true, actually, and it's a weird period of history, actually. I mean, it's like their weird hatred of cats was a double-edged sword that they couldn't even have anticipated had the results it did. But yeah, I mean, basically, they helped in their own demise, and the Black Plague was horrible. I mean, it killed, what, half the population of Europe?
Something like, I don't know. It was really, really bad. I know one pope kept himself safe from the Black Plague by sitting outside inside of a ring of fire. And that would keep the evil spirits away from him. And it actually was really effective because it did keep the evil spirits away from him because the fleas couldn't cross this barrier without going up in a puff of flame. So,
true enough.
it was effective for the wrong reason, but it was effective. Anyway, but yeah, familiars. So it became understood that the evil demons would take the shape of animals to be disguised and so that they could be in the area of the witch. Now, my point for all of this was, okay, what possible sense does it make for a witch to go out and curse the crops so that they don't grow when she's living in the same area that these crops are growing at and she has to eat just like everyone else? It makes,
well,
you know.
Clearly.
She's living on Satan's teat.
It's such a weird concept, too, because, I mean, they were an agriculturally dependent society, so clearly the idea of scapegoating some herbalist or midwife or what have you, it probably made sense because, you know, a woman who was in touch with the female reproductive cycle had to have some, you know, dark, sinister motives, because there's nothing so terrible as, you know, keeping a woman healthy during her pregnancy. My God, how can you even think of that?
Well, also understand the general attitude. It's not so much normal now, but it's still kind of prevalent in some societies. You have this full-grown woman that bleeds for a week every month, every 28 days, and doesn't die. And she does this from the time that she's 12 until she's about 50-something. And, you know, this is like, what the fuck? You know, all the men are going, this is not normal. This is strange. If I opened up a vein on my arm and bled every 5 days out of every month, I couldn't survive. But women are doing this all the time. So that was seen as something unnatural anyway. Which kind of makes me think these people are really, really stupid, because this is nature. This is nature in action. Yeah, a cat and a dog may not do it, but But other mammals do.
Well, I'd imagine that, yeah, for sure. Other animals go through that process, so it would seem, I don't know why it wouldn't seem natural, but maybe it's because animals do it that it seemed, it was like seen as lowly and animalistic and somehow beneath humans to do because it was just so filthy and, you know, dirty and so on. And they didn't they didn't have the knowledge to connect reproduction to this bleeding process.
I do know that there were several religions back, way back in time, who saw it as ritual uncleanliness, and some of the very Orthodox Judaic primitive groups still see it that way. But in my opinion, it's another example of misogynistic jerks who can't keep it in their pants. Anyway.
Well, and I think...
Go ahead.
I think it's funny because, like, the Native American sort of view on that whole thing, as far as I'm aware, is that it's natural, and it's actually... It's the menstrual... Like, the time of a woman's period is seen as a very heightened time of power. So... Native cultures had what they would, I mean, what's kind of been called lately moon lodges, where a woman would go during her period where she would hang out with other women and, you know, she would be able to sort of talk and discuss her, you know.
Woman stuff.
Her life and whatnot. Yeah. And I think that's kind of part of where... women's mysteries comes in, because that is a time where girls would probably hang out with the elder women and learn things about life that they otherwise wouldn't have.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's still...
So it's kind of a...
No, finish.
Well, it's kind of a... two-sided coin, I guess, really, because it could be seen in one light and it could be seen in the other, but in the end it's still what happened, so whatever the motives were,
you know, it's whatever. It's, I still contend that in essence what you had right around the zeros and the 100s, it was two groups of holy people. You had the female holy people who did take care of the women and the girls and their menses and the things like the domestic stuff, like the animals and the crops that are growing in the fields. And then you had the male priests who took care of the religious identity as a whole of the community. So you had the healers and the priestesses who were taking care of all of the day-to-day stuff, and you had the great big thinkers of the Druids out here taking care of the communities and the contacts with others and things like that. And when the Romans came rolling in, they saw the Druids were making contact and were talking and were doing the acceptance speeches and everything like that, so they thought they were the religious leaders, wiped them out and left all the women alone. And the women's traditions moved down through the centuries in various folk remedies and things like that and became the witches that we know today, eventually. That makes sense to me, that they would have divided up those duties between the two classes of holy people, simply due to the fact that women were not, you know, seen as second-class people. They weren't thrown out. They weren't isolated during their menses. Childbirth was a community event. Fertility of the crops and the animals and the people and healing and everything like that was very important and very central to a lot of the day-to-day life. But then you have the Druids who are sitting over here who are the only ones that are talked about. But then we've got all this lore from herbalism and horse whisperers and, you know, midwives and things like that. And they just don't reconcile unless you had two groups of people.
So, well, and I think that's kind of the thing, too. Like, it seems to me, and I've read ideas from Philip Cargom and I want to say Ronald Hutton, but it might be, oh shit, what's the dude's name? He wrote A Brief History of the Druids. Can't remember his name anymore.
Isaac Bonowitz?
I'm pretty sure. He probably researched from that other guy's book. Bonowitz is a great author, though. I thought I had it on the shelf somewhere. But
well, there was Triumph of the Moon.
Yeah, that's... anyway.
Anyway.
Yeah, Triumph of the Moon does discuss it for sure. But basically, the idea is put forward that the division between witches and druids was, as you say, it was because the Romans saw that the druids were kind of the official
faith
priest class. Yeah, exactly. And you know, they describe in that battle on or of Anglesey or whatever.
Yeah, the Battle of Anglesey.
That's the one. Where the women were, you know, dressed in black and they had wild hair and they're shrieking curses at, you know, the Romans and so on.
And running back and forth and blessing the troops and getting them stirred up and their blood high so that they can go and slaughter the Romans and then they all get killed.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I mean, you have to realize too that the Romans described the Celts in the way that would make them appear the most shocking and dangerous. So, but, I mean, the idea basically seems to me that the women who were the sort of subtle, the healers, the midwives, etc., they weren't such a public spectacle. And because the Roman soldiers weren't so much worried about the women's health issues, I guess, because their women weren't with them until, you know, it was basically decided it was safe for them to be there, and then they would move them in. But it seems to me that the reason that, quote, witches and druids were separate was out of the fact that druids were public and the healers did their thing sort of in the shadows kind of deal. Mm-hmm. And I think honestly that's kind of where you get the whole association of witches with the
female
night and shadows and mm-hmm. and so on, because it was sort of less of a public thing, because I mean you're not really going to have a woman pull up in, you know, city hall, say, and give birth on the mayor's desk.
No, not really. I mean, it just makes.
I imagine that would be an interesting spectacle.
Oh, I'm
and it
sure
probably
it would
make the news nowadays.
I'm just, it's. It just makes more sense, because I mean, you have a society that's pretty egalitarian, that while it's not reviling one sex over the other, it's and it's not lauding the other sex over one. It has, you know, duties that are assigned to each. Because if you look, the craftsmen were men for the most part. There were females that did it, but mostly it was men. And that's stuff that, you know, takes a lot of physical power. It takes a lot of upper body strength to sling this 10-pound hammer around to beat a piece of metal into a plowshare. You know, but you have women who are doing mm-hmm. jewelry and braiding things and making clothes. That takes a lot of precise control, not so much hard physical effort. So you have these, you know, domestic duties that are divided amongst the sexes. Why not have religious duties divided amongst the sexes as well?
Well, exactly. And I think that I mean, there's been a lot of talk over the past, say, 20 years about, you know, the gendered mysteries. And I kind of think that that is something that pagans generally should take a look at, because it's not that men and women are different, you know, unequal somehow. It's that they're equal but different. They perform different roles, and there's not this kind of false sense of it being mandated by anyone. It's simply that in the practical existence of their daily lives, you know, there were certain things that men were better at and certain things that women were better at. So, you know, they kind of took those roles out of practical consideration, I guess, because, you know, women who were giving birth probably, or women who had given birth, were probably better suited to midwifery and to addressing problems in childbirth than would be a man who will never give birth. So, you know, he's going to probably know some things. He might know how to cauterize a wound with, you know, like a firing or a flaming brand or whatever, but he's not going to know the delicate sort of female healing work. So I think the idea of the surgery that you would have seen in the past that was related to heavy labor or soldiering or what have you was going to be in the experience and expertise of men who were dealing with those issues. So, I mean, you probably had battlefield
surgeons,
healers as well, who who were women, who, because there were women who went out in battle and so on. So I think it just sort of unfolded that way, and it's not really a construct in the same sense that someone might claim it is nowadays.
And please understand, those of you who are listening to this, we're focusing mainly, or I'm mostly focusing on the British Isles, mainly because that's where a lot of modern paganism has developed out of. All the Wiccan groups, a lot of the mystical orders like the OTO or the Golden Dawn or things like that came out of either continental Europe, which is France, Italy, Spain, or the British Isles itself, okay? We're not ignoring the stuff that happened in Arabia or India or down in Africa or anything like that. It's just that we don't know about it. But tribal life, as depicted in Africa, is pretty much that way. You have the medicine man who is, or the shaman, who takes care of the religious life of the community, and then you have the herbal midwives who are taking care of the women's issues and the childbirth and the pediatrics and things like that. So it makes sense that a similar pattern would hold in the European, the Northern European areas and Central American areas as well.
I imagine it basically held true all over the world, and the idea of what we now term as sacred prostitutes, for instance, was probably kind of developed out of the understanding that males and females got together to create life. So if a man couldn't figure out his own issue, like he couldn't get it up or whatever, and there was only so much that a man would know about fixing that, then it would make sense to go to a woman who, perhaps because a woman is a source of arousal for men, that, you know, a woman might understand how to get him hard, you know, etc. So, I mean, I think the healing traditions that have developed over time aren't really human constructs so much as they unfolded because biology just sort of made sense in that sense, you know, because you get like, is it the sand bushman in Africa? I think it's the sand who, basically, the women know women's things. Like, they know how to medicate their children. They know how to heal each other. They know about problems with pregnancy, etc. The men have their own medicines. And it's handed down traditionally just because in their lifestyle, which is pretty much strictly hunter-gatherer, neither gender needs to know everything there is to know about both genders as far as their medical, medical issues are concerned, right? Because the boys are hanging out with their fathers, going hunting, etc. The women are hanging out with their mothers. The kids are hanging out with their mothers. So the women have a greater knowledge of the wild medicines that help them. Mm-hmm. If anyone's interested, sorry, go ahead.
No, you finish.
I was just thinking about this really great Canadian series that was on APTN, Aboriginal People's Television Network, in Canada. It's called Medicine Woman, and it was about a modern doctor who decided that she wanted to get in touch with her native roots. So she travels across, like, basically around the world talking to various and sundry healers of various types. So, you know, she talks to, like, a woman in Ireland, can't remember her name, who runs a healing college, a herbal college dedicated to Brigid, and who identifies herself as a druid priestess and talks about fairy lore and stuff. And then there's, like, she talks to the San Bushmen and talks to the women about their medicines, and she goes to like New Zealand and Australia and Indonesia and so on, travels around the world talking to various cultures, Aboriginal cultures, about their various healing traditions. So, you know, she's hoping to gain insight about how she can improve on her modern medical training by incorporating mind, body, spirit into her practice. Mm-hmm. And it's all related to like specific training for each gender in various cultures. And it's not that it was like somehow, you know, created out of hatred for women. It was simply what a matter happened, of practicality.
Yeah. It's what happened naturally and organically. What I was going to point out was this is also why you get matrilineal societies that are ruled by men, because what winds up happening is you always know where the baby came from because you actually see the child come out of the mother's womb. So you always know who the mother is. The father is kind of a little up in the air because she could have had sex with 8, 9, 10 different men over the course where she could have gotten pregnant from. So everything was inherited through the female side of everything because you knew who the child's mother was. But men doing war, being physically stronger, going out and fighting other men, conquering other tribes, would be more suited to ruling a tribal society. So that's where you get the inheritance through the mother, but ruled by guys.
Sure. it would be a real tough thing to sort of assist a woman giving birth by blindfolding yourself so that you didn't actually know what the child looked like.
You know, and
I can't imagine how that would work.
Well, it's
like
awesome,
you grow up. This kid doesn't even know his own mother.
Mm. Well, as I understand it, and I have yet to see definitive proof of this to make me believe it. But as I understand it, it was understood at one point in the past that men had nothing to do with reproduction. I find this very hard to believe. Because of the cause and effect. You have cause. Guy sleeps with woman. Has sex with woman. A couple months later, she's missing her periods. 9 months later, you have a baby. Okay? There's going to be a causality there that says, hey, men have something to do with it. You know? But in a primitive society that, you know, believes in spirits and everything like that, I can see how it would be perceived that a man had nothing to do with it, that it was all the woman's thing and all a gift of the goddess. I don't credit it
perhaps
too much, simply because, like I said, just basic observation would show that the guy had something to do with it, even if they didn't realize that sperm
You'd
were
think.
Coming out, you know.
Or at least one of the guys somewhere in that group might have had something to do with it, because actually it's funny that you say that, because it made me think of this really great novel that I read once called The White Bone, and it's basically life from the perspective of a herd of elephants. So, you know, this female elephant is basically rooting around doing elephant things, and they talk in terms of the male elephant digging her baby channel. So, you know, the writer comes up with this concept of the male elephant digging a baby channel that, you know, basically after the gestation period produces offspring. And it's a really interesting sort of thing to think about, like how it could be perceived in different cultures. 'Cause I think most human cultures are probably aware that, you know, babies come from, you know, males and females hooking up and doing their thing.
Well, just by watching the
dogs I would
in the
imagine
field,
that,
you know. Why do you ask?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure, like, it would be impossible. Like, and you know there's going to be somewhere along the line some horny dude decides he's going to try and fuck a sheep or whatever. And, you know, hey, wait, there's no baby out of that. What the hell? Mm. You know, so it's kind of a matter of process of elimination, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, he can fuck squirrels and rabbits and sheep and goats and all this kind of stuff, and there's no offspring produced. So why is it that when he's having sex with a woman, a human woman that is, that a baby's produced if he has nothing to do with it?
Yeah, I know.
I mean, I can imagine that the story of satyrs and centaurs and so on probably came out of some dude's mind while he was having sex with his horse or something.
Oh,
but,
God.
You know, like, well, because I can't remember. I saw a documentary where they were talking about exactly that issue, where it was like a matter of showing your sexual prowess or your manliness by having sex with your horse.
Okay, let me talk to that for just a little bit.
It's actually on YouTube.
there was a myth a long time ago that that the rulers of at least a lot of the Celtic Isles would have to have sex with a horse to become king. The myth, I think, started by the idea that the land is represented as a female. And you see this over and over and over in a lot of the mythology with the goddesses being sovereignty. Okay? And eventually it got convoluted through goddesses being associated with horses like Epona and Rhiannon, or with the virility of horses being seen as a necessary component to other things, that in order to be a leader, you had to have sex with this horse. Personally, I think that it might have happened once or twice, and people just went, that's way too fucking strange, and kind of got rid of it fairly quickly. But it's possible. As much as it squicks me out, it's
that's
possible.
Not to say that there aren't... Yeah, that's not to say that bestiality wasn't practiced on some level by some rulers or something.
Yeah.
Just because bestiality still exists in, you know, a minority of people. So
when clearly you got YouTube videos probably up there of a dog screwing a woman. It's yeah. Moving on.
Wow, that was a terrible subject to get into.
Oh, God. let's segue into something else. listen, while we're floundering around looking for a different subject to talk about, let me talk to you listeners about the site and everything that's going on. Recently, we had to buy a larger site because of the bandwidth limitations. What wound up happening was, I think the connection that we have up on iTunes was sucking up all of our bandwidth. And when you're talking about 100 gigs a month in bandwidth, that's a heck of a lot. You're talking about, you know, a 50 megabyte podcast for 2 hours, and the one that was eating it all up was episode 16, the transgender episode, and it had been downloaded 3,000 times over the course of a month. Okay, so we had to upgrade the site to 300 gigabytes a month. It only cost us another $10, but that's another $10 that, you know, are out of our pocket. So please, if you're listening to this, do a couple of things. If you've got the money, please share it with us. We definitely need it. If you have topics that you want to talk about with us or want us to talk about, let us know about that. Our email addresses are the same as they were, brian@magicalmusings.net and joy@magicalmusings.net. We still are up on Tumblr, wide-worlds-joy.tumblr.com and cosmic-rebirth.tumblr.com. And there's always the website. If you're listening to this through iTunes, come to the website. There's more information there. There's other podcasts. There's all the Tarot Talk podcasts we had, and even a few articles that have nothing to do with the topic of the month. That's magicalmusings.net. Please come by, see us. If you've got an Etsy shop or something that you want us to advertise, we'll be more than happy to talk advertising rates with you, or something that, you know, is of interest to the pagan community. We are supported by you guys. We're not public radio, but we might as well be, because it's member support that keeps all of this going for you. since we've started pushing this a lot more every episode, we actually have had a few people contact us in various points. We had one nice lady give us $50, which helped defray the costs and everything for the website, which was a huge help. I mean, don't think that your $10 contribution is not anything. It really isn't. $10 is half of what we need to support the site for a month. All right? That's what we're dealing with here. Brian and I take no salary out of this. We're not paid. There's no producers in the background that we have to pay. All of our expenses are the website. And it's $20 a month. So $10, $5, $2 helps. It may not pay for it all, but it helps. Okay.
Well, and I mean, that's kind of one of the things too that caused us to sort of step back from doing regular weekly or biweekly episodes as well, was the fact that we didn't have a lot of interaction from our listeners, which is kind of disheartening when you put in the time to record shows and edit them and so on. Feedback helps a lot. You know, if there are topics that we haven't covered that you want to hear about, then we need to know that, because we can't really read your minds through a pre-recorded podcast that, you know, you might be listening to 6 months from the time it was published. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if there's things that you want to know about or questions you have or concerns or, you know, hell, criticisms of our show or us or whatever, by all means, say so, because we do like to know about these things.
And this is only about halfway through the recording for this session. I mean, we're at an hour and 15 minutes right now. We're not doing commercials over the air. We're not, you know, tuning you out or anything. We're not live. We don't have a call-in number or anything. So we do, you know, want to hear from you guys. It really does help. To be honest, I don't know how much time Brian was taking when we were still over on the Blog Talk Radio, but for me, at least, it takes me 2 hours to sit down and record the show with Brian. It takes approximately another 2 hours for me to edit the show down enough and get all the background, everything, and the dog barking and the cats jumping on me and the phone ringing and things like that, so that we can get that stuff out of there and get the show edited. Then it takes at least another half an hour for the show to get converted over to an MP3 format, and then another half hour to get it uploaded to the website. And then there's, you know, coming up with the page for the show. So we're talking about 6 hours of constant time on my day off, you know, and Brian's day off. I try to cut it down with Brian because he does actually have a job that he needs to get to. you know, and then we have to schedule around life. Like, we were going to record this yesterday, except we couldn't because the tree people were out cutting in his neighborhood and would have been picked up on Brian's microphone. So we had to reschedule today.
Oh,
yeah. So we've got that sort of
and
stuff,
then
too.
Nature threw a windstorm at me that was potentially going to cut off my connection, although the winds died down considerably. That won't be an issue. But, yeah, I mean, life happens, and regardless, we still incur costs with the podcast. If you guys want to know more stuff, if you guys want to hear more shows, then help us contribute money, time, questions. If you happen to be an author, then, you know, let's schedule some time to talk about your work, so that the three of us can sit down on a Skype call and we can record it and
you
know,
we can talk about it, and
you
can plug your books, and we can find out your opinion on some of these same topics. I mean, I'd love to do that.
We've had some interesting talks with people. Did we have Lupa at one point?
No, you had Lupa on Blog Talk Radio. I've been talking with her, and she's all for doing it. But she's got gaming every other Thursday, and since that's the day we generally record these on, we would have to schedule a time with her to sit down and actually do that.
Well, wonderful and useful world that it is. Starting next week, my days off go from Wednesday to Friday.
Oh, outstanding.
So my schedule is a lot more flexible starting next week, which is great.
And I'm still unemployed, so...
we had a really awesome session last December with Galina Kraskova, was it?
Yes, it was.
We had so much fun talking to her for like 2 hours, and
we were going to talk to her about the Isatru and find out what she knew about it, but it turns out she doesn't know a heck of a lot about the Isatru because she's not Isatru. She's a northern tradition, which is slightly different. It's kind of like the difference between the Druids and the Celtic Reconstructionists. There's enough of a difference there that they don't want to be seen in the same group.
It's true.
It turned into a wild ride with her ranting on everything.
We talked about a lot of stuff.
We did. It was fun. She wants to do it again, by the way.
That would be fucking hilarious. I love it. Because, yeah, I mean, we meant to talk about Northern Trad, and suddenly we were all talking about rites of passage and
racism,
activism, and oh, it was a wild discussion. And yeah, I mean, if you happen to be an author or know someone, or you are an active long-time person in the pagan community, or you've started an organization, if you happen to be Sam Wagar of the Congregationalist Wiccan Association, then hit us up, you know, et cetera. I mean, we want to talk to people who are pagan and discuss how to bring paganism into the day-to-day work of someone's life.
And remember, we're not here trying to espouse a certain version of paganism. Our primary focus with this podcast is the same as it's always been. We want to get Wicca or paganism 201, 301, 401, the advanced courses out there, because there's tons of books that give you the basics. They quote the same 12 primary sources with the same basic 100 facts. So if you need to learn how to be a pagan in just starting out, there's tons of resources out there. But once you move progress past that information, there's next to nothing. I can think of three books. I can think of three books offhand that I know of that are actually pagan 201 information, and I can't think of any other resources except
podcast. Yeah, and the interesting thing too is, I mean, there's so many topics that you could possibly cover in under the blanket heading of paganism that, you know, a lot of books don't touch on. Like, there's stuff that when I was a young new pagan in my teens, you know, there were like armloads of Wicca 101 books. And, you know, then as I got familiar with things, I started discovering things about like familiars and, you know, trance work and traditional witchcraft and, you know, magic, and on and on and on it went. I mean, there's so many topics that you can talk about. And then, you know, there's things that a lot of authors will avoid, you know, comparative religion and so on, which, at least from my perspective, growing up as a pagan, I felt was a really valuable thing to investigate, because learning only one tradition and isolating yourself with the knowledge related to that can, in some cases, breed fundamentalism. Mm. So that was kind of a turnoff for me, and that's why I left Wicca, because I met a lot of fundy Wiccans who were like, there is no other tradition, and everything is about, you know, hating the Christians and so on. It was like, but I mean, what of the Gnostics? You know, what of the, you know, ceremonial magic and so on? So there was topics that weren't getting discussed, and I felt that my Wiccan experience was lacking. Mm-hmm. So I started investigating all this other stuff, and that opened, you know, doors into entirely different subject matter and so on. So yeah, I mean, there's things that you'll read about in a lot of the basic books that, you know, everyone covers, but then there's topics you'll discover along the way that are like almost forgotten.
Yeah, and it's like a lot of the stuff that we talk about, you're not going to find in either the primary sources that are quoted in the 101 books or in the 101 books themselves. This is stuff that we found out through research and going, I wonder where that came from. Or saying, okay, well, I've read this book from this author that is really radical and out there, and that was part of the Gnostic movement. What else is out there about this, and how does it relate to what I'm studying now? You know, and finding out stuff like that, and that's how you get all of this additional information. That's how you start making the connections between archaeology and astrology and astronomy and the ley lines and New Age mysticism and all of this stuff together. That's how you start connecting them, because just having disjointed stuff of, okay, there are ley lines, and they're the energy lines of the planet, and they circulate around the planet, okay? And the ancients built Stonehenge, and it wasn't the Druids just worshipped there. But there's also medicine wheels over in the Americas that are essentially Stonehenge just built with cairns instead of large standing stones. And having those disjointed facts just laying there is interesting, but it's not useful. But when you start looking at, okay, there's these medicine wheels that appear all over the Americas, both South and North America, that are laid out along these astronomical lines, and they line up along the power lines, the ley lines, with other sites in other areas. And if you follow them around, you might be able to find another site that's undiscovered. And that's how some of these sites were found, is somebody took Stonehenge and a medicine wheel in Montana and lined up the map coordinates and found that they intersected at another point. And when they started looking there, they saw this giant landing strip for aliens and went, what the hell? You know, and that's how you find this stuff.
And speaking of which, actually, it puts me in mind, if you happen to be a fan of Ancient Aliens, they actually talk about a lot of, like, esoteric stuff. Hermeticism, alchemy, paganism, Gnosticism, you know, et cetera, that's all tied in loosely with their theories about, you know, ancient aliens and stuff. So, you know, if you happen to have found a particular episode of Ancient Aliens fascinating, then it probably had something to do with something that you might explore further in your research, mm-hmm. which, I mean, it's interesting watching that show and others like it and going, hey, wait, that stuff was talked about in, you know, that particular Hindu scripture, or, you know, that's a topic that's discussed in Theosophy or whatever. And it's really interesting that they're drawing more and more on those kind of topics.
What I find fascinating is that more and more ancient knowledge is coming back, and it's dovetailing so neatly with what we have now that it's just it's astounding. I mean, if you look at out of Hindu mythology, the chakras and the yoga that you do with the chakras and everything like that and the energy flows, and you start talking about to somebody that works with chi flows in China, and you start seeing correlations between them where they're talking about the exact same thing just in different nuances due to their religions and their cultural mores. Mm-hmm. And then you get into things like acupressure and acupuncture and reflexology, which uses those chakras and uses those energy points. And then you find modern doctors going in and going, hey, there's a point on this body that is energetically a lot higher than the surrounding tissue. I wonder what that is. And then finding all of these other points on the body that are doing the same thing. And then looking at a chart of acupuncture points and finding it lines up exactly with that chart. And you just, your mind just goes, and it goes bluey. And you go, well, maybe there was something to all of this. Except if you're already doing it, you already know there's something to all of it. It's just, it's wonderful that it's being proven out by further knowledge.
Well, and that's something that I'm going to be discussing when we do our herbal show as well, because I'm going to be talking mostly because it does directly relate, about like alchemy and spagyrics and hermeticism and all that, because there are so many different traditions that have sort of drawn the same information and have kind of enhanced herbal remedies through these other aspects that, you know, draw on the spiritual element as well. Mm-hmm. So look forward to that, probably early in the new year, January-ish, because there's a few books that I'm trying to read right now that are books that I've meant to read for a long time and that are, I'm hoping, are going to be really interesting additions to what I've already read and so on. So and we're also going to, go ahead.
Hang on to that. Just to let you guys know, this is not, the herbalism show is not going to be, Eyebright does this and Belladonna does that and, the lemon peel does this other thing. It's not going to be a list of correspondences and what they're used for. What it's going to be is it's going to be the stuff that isn't in the books, like what a tincture is, how to put together a poultice correctly.
There'll be discussions about some basic recipes and ideas, but I'm not going to be like advising you on how to use specific plants, because there are so many variables that affect the usefulness in a particular person. I mean, you may have allergies to something that I don't, right? So I may be able to use something at will that will close your throat and cause you greater suffering, you know, like in the case of the herbal cough syrup that I once tried that caused me an allergic reaction that made my sore throat a hell of a lot worse, because it closed my throat because I happen to be allergic to dandelion. So I'm not going to be recommending you use dandelion as a coffee substitute or as a, you know, a herbal remedy for anything, because I can't use it. So, yeah, I mean, in that case, and I'm, yeah,
that,
I mean,
that's
I'm
how we're going to be doing
dealing
is,
with a disclaimer.
Right,
so.
we're going to be doing it as basics that people assume that everyone knows, but that nobody really actually talks about. They assume that you know how to make a tea. Okay, I mean, you brew tea a lot. A lot of herbalists are like, okay, this is, you make a tea out of it, and everybody's like, what the hell, huh? How do you do that? And the herbalist, you know, sort of smacks their head at that point. Because, of course, everybody knows
exactly
how to make a tea. Why can't you know how to make a tea? You know, well, how do you do it? Do you put two tablespoons into the tea infuser ball, or do you use four, or do you load it as hard as you can? You know, how long do you steep
it? Yeah, for
it?
Sure. And actually, something that I'm hoping to experiment more with in the next few years is the use of honey in herbal remedies. Because actually, while I was studying, I can't remember if it was this book specifically, but I was reading Jan Irvin and Andrew Rutaji's book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, the Pagan Roots of Christianity. And they mentioned something called blue honey, which is an ancient psychedelic honey that there was actually an army that used to steer the Romans away by getting them stoned on honey.
Weird.
Yeah. They would leave pots of it, like, around, and then whoever was using it would get stoned on it because it was, like, psychedelic or, you know, something like that. So,
what is it with you and psychotropic things? Because you're talking about mushrooms on our Yule episode and then the mushrooms on our Easter episode and getting stoned and high on this, that, and the other. Are you a stoner or something?
Funny enough, I'm not actually, like, I've smoked weed in my life like half a dozen times. It's not something I feel compelled to do, but the idea of using psychedelics in herbal healing is something that fascinates me, because I, like, there's more and more books coming out in recent years that talk about the psychedelic associations of things like ayahuasca and so on. And, yeah, so I mean, it's become something that I'm getting more interested in, because it ties to herbal remedies, and I'm also looking into my personal First Nations heritage as far as their healing traditions are concerned. I've got an aunt who has promised to put me in touch with native healers in BC once I get Master Herbalist certification. So,
wow.
It's something that I'm kind of like expanding on by exploring different areas. So I want to use honey because I've come across books that talk about apitherapy and honey as a healing ingredient. And I mean, the ancient Egyptians used honey as an antiseptic. And that's kind of the reason that, jars of honey have been found in ancient Egypt, I think in Tut's tomb, actually, that were still edible. I mean, they crystallized,
yeah,
but...
I find it fascinating that the stuff was still good, you know.
So, yeah, I mean, and it's weird to me as well that vegans see a problem with human use of honey, because I think our species has had a connection to honey and bees for millennia. So even if I was to sort of take on the vegan diet, I would have no problem using honey. And I know that there are a lot of people who would say, oh, you're a hypocrite and so on and so forth. But it's like, why would I not use that? And actually, it's funny too, because I used a quote that I found in a documentary called Queen of the Sun. Absolutely fantastic documentary about bees. And there's this doctor, like a biologist or something, who talks about the fact that bees use they gain their food sources from the sun, you know, through the plants, obviously. Mm-hmm. So what they do is they digest pollen and turn it into honey, and they also produce wax out of their own bodies. And so he says this really poetic thing about the fact that through the course of the summer, bees are taking in light, and then we as humans have the ability to draw on the sunlight that bees have sort of preserved and transformed into honey and wax. So that we can have like beeswax candles in the winter and so on and so forth. So honey and beeswax are kind of elements I'm bringing into my own winter solstice practices as well.
That's cool.
Yeah, so I don't know, like it's kind of weird the ways that honey ties together with psychedelics and healing and, you know, the solstice and all this kind of stuff. So,
and then
yeah,
there's the fermented honey with mead and things like that.
Yep. Oh, and, yeah, it's a weird bit of study to draw on. And yeah, so those are things that I'm looking into as well and tying to my own herbal studies.
It's strange that you should mention about the beeswax and stuff, because in past life regressions and checks on my past lives, one of the farmers that I lived as had extensive beehives. Sold the honey, made beeswax candles, and because of that, I got very interested in chandlery while I was in the SBA.
Nice.
And made my own beeswax candles and sold them, and made a pretty good living off of it. There was one event that I went to where I took the sheets of wax and would roll them up right there in front of you, sold them for like $4 a pair, and these things would last like 5 hours or something. And
yeah, definitely.
There were three other merchants at this event aside from me. And it cost like $40 to get in. And I was the only one that made any money at that. Everybody else lost. And it was like, wow, I did something like $350 worth of sales. It was just incredible. I loved it.
Yeah, it's actually pretty interesting because I get the sense that at some point I was a Franciscan friar who looked after bees, because Franciscan spirituality has been something that keeps coming up in my life, you know, time and again. And there's this weird connection to beekeeping that I find really fascinating. And so I'm kind of, I don't know, I see bees as one of my little power animals because they have this just fascinating relationship with our species. And they have so much impact culturally, you know, in all these places around the world. And, you know, there are bee goddesses and so on that, you know, are kind of almost forgotten because there's not much written about them. And then, of course, there's like the Greeks who actually associated bees with Zeus for some reason.
And I find it interesting that everywhere when you talk about paradise, it's the land of milk and honey.
Honey,
it's like,
yeah.
Wow.
It's true. And and it's kind of weird, too, when you think about it, because you've got, like, milk animals, goats, cows, what have you, that they stem from agricultural development. And bees, while they were a wild source of honey and so on, they also became domesticated as well. And they both provide steady food supplies and calories that are needed in the parts of the world where they're relied upon.
Mm-hmm. And I believe, isn't it, aren't domestic honeybees one of the first domesticated animals ever?
Well, I think what happened was that humans kind of realized that they had this capacity to produce honey, and they basically accidentally stumbled across this delicious food source. And I think what happened is they started developing a relationship where they could control the bees from getting, you know, into a swarm, so that they would be stung to death in acquiring honey. And it sort of created a natural symbiosis of, like, humans protecting the bees so that they could produce the honey safely, and then, you know, harvesting some of the honey for themselves while leaving plenty for the bees. And then, of course, over time, they discover all these healing properties and things that honey has. So, you know, it influences the development of human culture and healing and so on. So, yeah,
I think good for rheumatoid arthritis, and I'm absolutely terrified of stinging bees, so I run screaming. It's right
well,
there after
the
clowns.
Like, that's kind of the thing too. Like, apitherapy is something that has fascinated me for so long, but it's something that you really don't get a lot of resources to learn, because I mean, ultimately it does mean that a bee will die if it has to sacrifice its sting for you. So naturally, like in the wild, bees aren't going to go crazy and sting you, unless they absolutely feel that you are a threat to their hive. Even in like the domesticated beehives, the little bee boxes that you find at a honey farm or whatever, the bees will swarm, and there are a few that will sting just out of a defensive instinct, but generally they're more concerned with the well-being of the hive and the developing larvae and so on than they are with predators. And that's why one of the things that you get warned about when you go into a honey farm is that you should never wear dark colors, because those, like the animals that attack hives to steal the honey, are generally big, dark, creatures, like bears, for instance.
Yeah.
So you don't want to look like a bear because bees have a natural instinct to sting dark colors. So if you wear white and yellow and pink and so on, and you're going and, you know, harvesting honey, they're not going to sting you as likely because they don't see you as a threat.
Yeah, and this brings up a good point. It's been stated on Tumblr and shown on Tumblr many, many times, these huge hives that wind up happening in abandoned houses or occupied houses or in the attic or something like that, where there's just, you know, hundreds of thousands of bees, and you'll see some idiot comment, you know, get the exterminator out and kill them all. And one thing that I would like to say is, you know, get the exterminator out to take them away, not to kill them, because bees are extremely important. If it weren't for bees, you wouldn't have the produce section of your grocery store.
Pretty much.
So, yeah.
Get the
beekeepers to take them away. They will very gladly go, oh, thank you.
Well, and the thing, too, I think the problem that people have is the Africanized killer bees are the ones that will build these massive nests in abandoned places because they're just doing what bees do by instinct. You know, they're basically setting their own place to live. The only thing that makes them dangerous is the fact that they're not native, so they don't know the predator population, like, whereas you get wild bees all over the place. I mean, bumblebees are kind of cool looking, and they're the ones you hear the low hum of when you enter a flower garden or whatever. And they don't have that inclination. I mean, a bumblebee will sit calmly while you pet it and so on. Africanized killer bees are the ones that people are afraid of because they've come up from the south, like from South America, and they're spreading across the southern United States. Mm-hmm. And once they breed with domesticated swarms, those swarms tend to become more hostile, aggressive. Yeah. When they haven't themselves been destroyed by these African bees. Yeah, I mean, ultimately, bees as a general species are not going to harm you. They're going to do what they do naturally. They're going to live their lives. They're going to produce food for their offspring. They're going to, you know, build hives and swarm. And, like, if you see a swarm in person, it's not something to be afraid of. It's bees doing what they do, right? Like, they're protecting their queen. That, above all, is like the central guiding principle of a hive, is to protect the queen because she is the one who produces the offspring.
Mm-hmm. And remember, when you see a swarm, if you see a huge amount of bees, a big ball of bees that aren't in a hive, aren't in a hollow, but they're exposed for everybody, they're in the middle of swarming. They're trying to find another home. So calling a beekeeper mm-hmm. to come out and collect them and give them a home actually helps them out.
Yeah, for sure.
Hang on. Yes, Mary.
What?
Hi, I'm in the middle of recording.
That was a bagpipe piece called The Minstrel Boy.
Hi. It's my ringtone for the goddess of all research, Mary. Scotland the Brave.
Oh my, that's funny.
Yeah. It's because she's got her area of the dead over in Scotland and England, and she essentially, I was talking last episode with the dragons and me being in charge of an area in Japan and taking care of the dead there. Mary does the same thing in Scotland. So we have a lot of back and forth between the souls and stuff, and so I associate Scotland the Brave with her. So, anyway.
Fair enough.
But yeah, but okay, trying to get back to spirits. We were talking about spirits. I can't think of anything that we haven't covered with them, really. Just be polite. Remember that they're always themselves. They're going to look like what they want to look like, and you just have to realize that they're intelligent. Treat them like you want to be treated. Angels, demons, kitsune, warriors from 100,000 years ago, it doesn't matter because they're all spirits, they're all on the same plane, they're all where you're at, obviously. Oh, and yeah, don't ever think that you're alone. There's always spirits around you, okay? Now, as weird as that is, because it means that you're not alone when you're taking a shower,
or doing any other thing on your own.
Yeah, private time in the bedroom. Realize that for the most part, they don't give a shit. It's part of life, and it's something that they can't do anymore, and they may be a little jealous, but they're not going to hurt you. You don't have to actively ward out all of these other entities because they're around and they're going to try to kill you, because they're not. Yes, every house is haunted, okay? They all have spirits in them. There's probably spirits sitting in the room with you right now. And you know what? Doesn't matter. Because they're not trying to do anything. They're just living their lives out. And it's an existence beyond the physical life, okay? It's actually what I assume to be the real life. Now, what I mean by this is that you have the here and now. You have the physical life. And we're here to learn very specific lessons. This is going to second grade. We're learning to color. We're learning to get along with each other. We're learning to share our toys. When we die, we actually go on summer vacation. And we build on what we learned while we were alive. We look at what we learned. We figure out what lessons we want to learn next time, and then we come back to life, okay? And that's what the cycle of life and death is. So the actual true existence of you is not who you are in your body while you're sitting in front of your television listening to this podcast. It is who you are after you no longer have a body. Okay, and that's where the real person is at. And I saw a quote that I thought was just absolutely gobsmacking when I read it. It's, you do not have a soul. You are a soul. You have a body.
I've seen and heard that one many, many times.
But it's true.
And it holds true in every religion. Like, you'll see it in Buddhism and in Gnosticism and in various and sundry pagan traditions. You'll see it in Hinduism, etc. Basically, it's understood in every culture that you are not the persona who walks the world. You are something far more within. Our culture directs you to look outward because it wants you to be a consumer. Mm. It wants, and a lot of people are uncomfortable with silence, with self-reflection, etc. If you're one of those people, I suggest that you condition yourself out of the fear. Because you won't really learn anything about yourself until you can get past that. The fear of silence and solitude.
And start listening to your internal dialogue. Once you start listening to that, your life is going to improve immeasurably. Because you're not going to be worried about what somebody else thinks about you. You're only going to be worried about what you think of you.
Exactly.
So, yeah, there's...
And speaking of psychedelics, the UPS guy just delivered Cannabis and the Soma Solution.
Oh, those are books, right?
Yes, yes,
okay.
They are.
All right.
And, yeah, it's talking about the significance of cannabis in various religions, so...
That's pretty cool. Well, I'm glad that, you know, America or the United States is actually starting to realize that hemp and cannabis in general is not nearly the horrible thing that it's been portrayed as. I actually saw a very interesting article where back when the paper industry and the textiles industry was just getting a good foothold during the Industrial Revolution, that the hemp industry was already there, and they were making tons of money. But because you can make textiles out of hemp, you can make paper out of hemp, you can make all kinds of other things that we use daily out of hemp, but you also have the psychedelic factor of the marijuana and the cannabis. And because of that psychedelic factor, the textile and paper industries got together, managed to get it banned, and totally crashed out the hemp industry, which they then took over.
Well, and it's funny too, because like hemp in say the 18th century predominantly was used in making rope.
Mm-hmm.
The smokeability of it was it's used in making what? Jute? It's obviously used for hemp twine as well.
Manila.
Anyone who does macrame is probably familiar.
And there's several different types of the tri-twist rope, the manila rope.
Yep.
That's the same stuff.
It's true. I mean, you don't see it as often in, like, hardware stores and stuff, but because, I mean, they tend to go for the plastic petroleum-based ones. Personally, when I was a kid, we used to use hemp I guess it would have been manila rope to do our pioneering and scouting. So, yeah.
Well, one of the reasons
it's biodegradable.
It is, and one of the other reasons is that it's rough. I mean, think about it. You've got the polyester blends and the cotton blends and everything like that, and it's smooth and it's slick. And that's great if you're moving things over a branch, but if you're trying to climb up it, it's going to be nearly impossible. But with hemp and the manila rope, you've got a heck of a good grip even with no gloves on. And you can just swim up the thing.
It's true. Actually, another book that came with that other one is called The Benefits of Marijuana, Physical, Psychological, and Spiritual.
Hmm. Well, we already know it's...
random thought.
No, it's a good thing, you know, with medical marijuana, and Oregon is... I think it's Oregon that just recently legalized it completely. It's like, okay, I want to move there.
You mean they don't follow California's example, where it's legal at state level and not at federal? What?
Well, one of the states, and I'm pretty – I think it's Oregon. It might be one of the
probably
other
is states. Oregon or Washington.
Yeah. No, it's not Washington. But anyway, they legalized it across the board. It's not illegal to own. It's not illegal to grow. It's not illegal to possess. They have stores that sell it. They tax the hell out of it. They regulate it. And they made something like an extra $20 billion this past year since they legalized it in state taxes.
Nice.
I mean, it's just this.
Well, and I think that's that's a completely reasonable thing. Yeah, it's a huge boon to an economy to grow and legalize it because, I mean, when we stop pretending that adults aren't capable of making their own decisions, then, you know, it gives us the freedom to explore consciousness in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, realistically, you've seen it portrayed in movies and TV forever.
I saw a YouTube video of a ex-police captain who is very erudite in legalization of all drugs, not just marijuana, but all drugs, and treating drug addiction as a social issue and a psychological and a health issue rather than as a criminal issue. decriminalizing it across the board, because prohibition doesn't work. Saying you shouldn't do it doesn't work.
Didn't.
And he's got massively good arguments. And one of the people that was interviewing is, well, if that's true, they'll just be growing it in their backyards. And he's like, and? You can grow tomatoes in your backyard. Are you doing it? No. Why? Because it's too much bother. You know, and they were like, well.
Exactly. With the amount of work involved in growing weed, I mean, people are going to be like, oh, my God. And honestly, if it's not a cash crop anymore, then people aren't going to feel compelled to, like, get involved with violent crime in acquisition of weed or whatever. I mean, like, the reality is legalizing drugs gives people the freedom to research psychological benefits and spiritual benefits and so on. I mean, it just makes more sense that way.
Professor, what's
so apparently,
with
yeah,
the LSD?
We at Magical Musings are all for the legalization of marijuana and other drugs.
And other drugs. Well, I mean,
who would have guessed?
Timothy Leary with LSD. He discovered that when you drop a hit of acid and study, and you'll come down off the acid and you won't remember a thing that you studied, but if you drop another hit of acid, you'll remember every single fact that you studied during that time perfectly. And it was
state-dependent,
like,
thinking, I believe it was called.
Something
along that line. They alluded to it in a movie called Around the Fire with Devon Sawa and Eric Mabius.
I found that.
Yeah, it's a weird little.
It's one of those weird little side effects that you could be, you know, absolutely eidetic recall with acid. It's like, and this stuff is illegal? Why? You know? Anyway. 50s hippies or 60s hippies here. Hi.
And actually, I was one of those, like, pseudo hippies in the 90s who was like, you know what? This is a lot of marketing and shit.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was one of those hippies who was kind of, who knew about it and who studied the 60s and 70s and read books, you know, that came out of that era.
But
I looked at the 90s version. Well, no, I looked at the 90s hippies and kind of was like scoffing at them because they all seemed to be so much into the superficial, you know, store-bought hippie thing, but not as much into the philosophy and things
right.
like that.
Yeah, the
I
stuff
was like,
behind it.
Because, like, the 90s were rife with things. You'd go into any store, and my sister used to frequent a few, like, girly clothes stores that had, like, peace signs and all that kind of shit on everything.
Oh, God, the head shops.
And
yeah.
I just looked at a lot of the hippies. I looked at hippie kids in high school and was like, okay, so you guys don't actually research any of the interesting ideas behind the movement, you just kind of go for the look of it.
And
so I
disassociation from reality aspects of it.
There was a lot of that, unfortunately. I mean, it became so superficial I was just turned off by the whole thing. I mean, there was a lot of people I probably would have connected really well with, but I tended to be kind of a quiet, not antisocial, but yeah, quiet, introverted, philosophical type hippie in mm-hmm. those days.
I wasn't really with you.
So yeah, I mean, I don't know. I probably was born 30 years too late, but
no,
you know, aside from.
I always used to think that, and I finally came to the conclusion that I was born right when I needed to be, because, yeah, some of the attitudes are from other decades, other centuries, but you need people in the current time periods who have those attitudes to bring them back and to reintroduce them to society again, which is what we're doing here.
It's true. And, yeah, and actually, one of the things that I ended up inadvertently doing on Tumblr is becoming a mentor to a lot of quote, aspiring hippies. and I've, you know, been kind of directing people in terms of their spiritual searching and in their kind of curiosities about other aspects of what it could mean to be a hippie. And I've been bringing people's attention to the Back to the Lander movement, you know, which tends to have been forgotten because people think that being a hippie nowadays is just about getting stoned and wearing reggae Rasta colors.
Yeah, there was a lot that came out good. It was just at the wrong time, and the counterculture was too counter. And it caused a reaction because it was so counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
And it made the culture fight back, you know, so. But anyway.
Yeah, what it seemed to me to be.
Sorry, I hate to keep cutting you off.
That's okay. It happens all the time. We're completely simpatico with that.
Yeah.
But it occurs to me that the movement had to – it had a lot of things that it could have done if it had only been more organized. But the whole idea of, like, counterculture in those days seemed to be so against – organizing in structured ways. So it probably could have had a great impact if people weren't so deterred by the whole, you know,
I think
idea
a lot
of organizing themselves.
Yeah, it's a lot like what happened to the
Occupy movement?
Occupy movement, exactly. Because they were so against organizing at any level that there was no way for anybody that supported them to contact anybody to work with them to bring it to other areas.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there comes a point when anarchy is too much like herding cats, and in that it's self-defeating.
Anarchy got defined by me by a webcomic called Something Positive. In there was a character by the name of Davin who was taken by a couple of his friends to a stoner, not a stoner bar, but one of the dark goth emo bars. And he goes in there in a bowling shirt and blue jeans, and everybody else is in dark everything, and life is terrible and horrible. And this one guy comes up and he starts screaming at Davin because he's in a bowling shirt. And, you know, anarchy is the rule of the universe. And Davin reaches over and grabs his hand and starts smacking the shit out of him with his own hand, going, "Stop hitting yourself, pansy! Stop hitting yourself! Stop hitting yourself!" And the guy's like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "You want anarchy? You want Eris? This is it. It's your high school lunchroom forever. Give me your lunch money now!" And beating him with his own hand. And it's like, yeah, that's pretty much it. Because that's what the whole counterculture, anarchy, you know, the no order as order, that's exactly what it is. It's high school all over, forever. But anyway, that is it for the show. We've gone 8 minutes over, in fact, but some of that's going to be cut out. So anyway, guys, listen, if you need to go back, listen to the middle of the show again where we're begging you to get in touch with us. All our contact information is there. We do like hearing back from you. We want to know what you're thinking. We want to get the donations from you. We like hearing from you guys. And the more we hear from you, the more we're going to respond to you and the better able to help you we will be. If you want to look at it like one of the courses that you take in a pagan learning center, where you go and sit and listen for a couple of hours to the speaker of the day, and then they pass the hat around, and then they ask for the questions from the audience. This is the Q&A time and the hat passing around time, okay? You've gotten a product. You've gotten a good product. Now it's time to give back so that the product continues to be there, all right? So,
and, I mean, honestly, folks, if there's things that we touched on today that you want to hear more about, then say so. Otherwise, if you have show ideas, topics you want to hear more about, let us know, because you know, we kind of try to come up with shows each month that we haven't previously touched on. And, you know,
we're running out of topics.
And besides, I mean, we don't know what you guys want to hear about. So, you know, what we might find fascinating isn't going to be well received by some of you. And, you know, it might be that we don't touch enough on a topic that you guys are thrilled about. So,
and
say something
to us. Let me stress something, because I'm harping on the money a lot, because it's really on my mind. If you can't donate, or if you absolutely don't have the funds for it, we understand that. You don't have to apologize for that. You can still write us. We'll take your donation in thought. You know, if you can donate, if you can contribute to this, we would ask you to. All right. This is not trying to guilt you out, although it really is. but you know, we do need the feedback, because we've got egos that need to be stroked just like everybody else. So anyway, I'm going to stop recording now and wish all of you a very good life, okay?
Enjoy yourselves this month, folks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.